This affinado, the theme music for the WPKN book program Literary Discord. By Discord, we are not that interested in the advance Mrs. So-and-so got for her latest novel. We try to talk about more meaningful aspects of publishing, which is in itself like a besieged tower, and we have to really be careful if we don't want it to crumble at our feet. I'm Hans Koning. Today we have as our guest Benjamin DeMott, who is a son of the very well-known Professor DeMott, who is a literary professor of literature in New England. And Benjamin is here as the editor-in-chief of The First of the Month, which is a magazine he founded with Charlie O'Brien and Armand White, and which is, you know how difficult, it's so easy to start a magazine in New York, but it's bloody difficult to keep it going. And I think they got something there, because they print something like 70,000 copies at the moment. It's a monthly. So I asked him to talk about his magazine, First of the Month, ask him what the philosophy behind it is, and specifically try to nail him down on the politics. Does the fiction he print have a political message, and what is the political angle of the magazine as such? He may go off in his own direction, of course, but it's all relevant to our subject.
The three folks who are involved in putting it together in the beginning, Armand White, who's currently a film critic for New York Press, Charles O'Brien, and myself, first came together as friends and writers in a working for a black nationalist newspaper called The City Sun, which was put out in Brooklyn in the late 80s and early 90s, folded in the mid 90s. Armand was the culture editor for that paper, and we all sort of wrote for it. And during that time, in the late 80s and early 90s, we have sort of had a sense that, in kind of a strange way, it seems sort of small-minded perhaps now, but at the time we had a sense of our newspaper and that newspaper as being in a sort of war with the Village Voice, of all things. We had a kind of sense that the sensibility that the Voice represented was deeply problematic. And when the City Sun faded and we were kind of lost and trying to find a place for us to write, and we decided to start our own newspaper. And there were, as I say, a sort of couple sort of newspapers that we kind of defined ourselves in a certain kind of way against, you know. And one of them, as I say, was The Voice. And I think there's a way of kind of speaking to what we imagined the problem with a certain kind of bourgeois bohemian sensibility was. And the best way to think about that would be to sort of focus on a praise word, actually. And I think this goes to believe it or not, to the whole question of responses to fiction as well as responses to a whole range of popular culture. And that praise word is the word smart. It was a word that Robert Christgau was an editor at The Voice and a rock critic and actually a sort of prominent cultural figure in a certain kind of way. It was his favorite praise word. And by the late 90s, it had migrated all the way throughout the culture. Entertainment Weekly used to refer to, we're looking for the kind of book, the kind of movie, the kind of record, the kind of, that the smart kids liked in high school. And I think you probably get a little sense of why that might be as a final word of praise for any kind of work of art or cultural product of any kind might be a little problematic. I mean, Dick Cheney's smart. Is smart, it's a neutral, there's no moral valence to it. If you think of it, there's a great phrase of Du Bois's that we loved. W.E. Du Bois used to speak of the world of dollars and smartness. And he knew that was a world that you wanted to resist if you were, you know, a person of the left, to put it bluntly. And that vision of smart, I think, I was trying to think for a moment as I was remembering way back when we started this thing in 98. Did we have an alternative to smart as a value word? And we actually really didn't. You know, we were very good at explaining what was wrong with that. I think we spoke and evoked emotion, which was sort of a word that was, but I went back to this to sort of, we were all kind of 60s sensibilities, and I realized there really was a word that kind of summed up, I think, what defined first politics of culture. And that was the word soul. And that was a 60s word, you know, you remember it, Hans. And it always did have, a moral valence, and it did have some dimension that really is left out from the world of the hip and the square and the smart and the dumb, you know, though that dialectic, that way of seeing the world. And if I think of the last issue of First, I think there are a couple pieces. One was your own work. Piuche, I thought that was a soulful work. But there's another one that just sort of occurs to me, and I'm just sort of thinking it's a piece of nonfiction, but it really would not appear, and I can't imagine it appearing really in another kind of journal. It was we published a couple times, sort of basically adapted emails by a guy named Father Frechette, who's a priest in Haiti. And I don't really think he has sort of explicit left politics. I think after the experience of Aristide in Haiti, you probably wouldn't be a heavy liberation theologian type anyways. It's just, the Aristide's corruption and so on made it all problematic in some kind of way, that vision of things. But what he does is he gives you a day-to-day feeling for the life of everyday people in Haiti on the streets. And he's a soulful fellow. And you can feel it in his writing. Right. So I would say that was one way of thinking about our way of imagining an approach to culture. And if I stick with that for a moment, I know I'm going on too long, but let me stick with it just for a second, and say that if you think of soul as a way of imagining, soulful versus smart, the other great tabloid of New York that sort of I think probably first of the month probably defines itself against is the New York Review. I think we'd all understand why soul is not a word that you would generally think of or apply to the New York Review. I think they probably had like two semi-regular black correspondents, black writers in the last 20, 25 years. They have Black Eye Reviews sort of fiction by people of color, and they have another guy named Anthony Appiah, who I think on his offhand writes murder mysteries, with like a Cambridge Don as the guy who solves both crimes and so on. I mean, life is short, whatever rings your bell. But the point is, they're not really. It's not an institution which is defined by its responsive to the great sources of black cultural creativity in this culture. And I'll give you two anecdotes, and then I'll shut up on that front. To the extent that the New York Review sums up a kind of ect New York intellectual response to American culture, I'm reminded of there's a great moment in the 50s when John Berryman, the poet, takes Delmore Schwartz upstairs and plays him some Bessie Smith records, right? And Delmore Schwartz is completely unresponsive. He's sort of saying, "What is it? Give me a pig foot and a bottle of what do you hear in this, right?" And I think everyone at first sort of response would have always been, "Well, look, man, if you don't get Bessie Smith or 100 other great popular musicians, I mean, literally hundreds, then there's really a point in living in America." my God, right? I think that was always a real sense that there was something missing from these magazines, and First has tried always to offer an alternative.
Well, I hope you're not going to suggest that all people who don't have a very good musical ear are going to be exiled, or at least are forbidden to marry each other or whatever.
Oh, well, no, there's no, it's more like you're sort of saying to yourself, why would you want to live in America? I would think you'd be an awfully sad person, basically. And I think that, I think that's actually sort of borne out to be the case. I mean, leftists, there are many sad people in America, on that front. I mean, there isn't, you're missing. I'll give you one more example just because it jumps to mind. There's Alan Lomax, the great folklorist, a man of the world, right? I mean, yeah. he recorded songs in Italy and went all around. Great man. But in any case, Lomax was reading Faulkner, and he wrote a book in the mid-90s called The Land Where Blues Began, which is an account of his sort of ethnographic excursions in the South. And he sat there just scratching his head because he realized, he's a Southerner. He loves Faulkner. Loves him to his bones, right? And then he just kind of sit there saying to himself, but, there's some part of him that will never really quite forgive. I'll admit that's the word he uses. Faulkner for having offered this vision of the South and somehow leaving out, this extraordinary, river of creativity that rolled through not just black people, but white people too. Country music is extraordinary, Just left it out. It's not there,
Yeah.
Now, before I go on, I have to say any man who created Joe Christmas and Lucas Beauchamp shouldn't be pissed on by me or anyone, in a certain kind of way. But Lomax had a point. I'll leave it there.
Okay. Of course he had a point. But it seems not only is it too severe for the poor devils who cannot appreciate this or even hear what is to be heard, but you can't say that without that there's no point in talking about American culture.
I wouldn't say there's no point in talking about it. I'm just saying that if in first of the month that's going to be a serious focus of ours, and it's going to be something which distinguishes and has distinguished our magazine from the New York Review and frankly, from The Voice, because The Voice does it in a different way. But
no, but when you say, what are these people doing in America, then you...
Well, I didn't say what are they doing in America. I'm just sort of saying, literally, why would you want to be here? You know, it would be like living in France and not eating. Really? Seriously. Well, I mean, there's no point. I mean, God.
You mean not you can eat in France, but you don't necessarily have to smack your lips and go on and on about truffles and what knows what. There are plenty of Sartre was not the least bit interested in eating, and he was a very great writer in my book and a very great philosopher.
And to the extent that he was a person who, when he came to America, did have a sense, even though he was, you know, he was a classical piano player himself. But he was also somebody who in the, and this is sort of the mythic dimension, obviously, but he was somebody who wanted desperately in his heart of hearts to be responsive to Charlie Parker, you know, and I mean, you know, let's put it this way, he's a Frenchman, you know, you know, I mean, he didn't quite get it, but he knew enough to try, and he knew enough to understand that jazz was a, you know, an immensely live and vibrant culture, and that it had, if you were an existentialist, you know, at the heart and essence of jazz was all about improvisation.
That
any existentialist would understand had a whole lot to do with, more to do with his philosophy than, for example, somebody learning to play classical music.
I agree. Listen, I'm not musical, but there's a lot of jazz that makes me cry, and 1 o'clock jump changed my life 100 years
there
ago.
There you go. Well, that's all I'm saying.
But in spite of that...
So, that's one of the reasons why you write for First, whether you know
that,
it or
I'm
not.
I'm quite ready to move to Canada. I don't know if you saw the article in the Times, all these people are going to Canada now.
There you go.
And they're very upset because this was supposed to be the country where people escape to and not escape from.
Right.
But now, I think you once reproached me that I didn't like America. Was that you?
I think it probably was me. But hey, I mean, you know,
I'm in the belly of the beast, as Che Guevara said, but it doesn't mean that I wouldn't be happier lying in the grass in the south of France. Anyway, if we can be a bit more dry, academic.
Okay.
I know it is not even quite what's foremost in your mind. It's not even foremost in first of the month, I now realize. But I would like to, on the other hand, there are a few people left with whom I would even try to talk about it. Susan Sontag was one, and I missed that. And Ed Doctorow promised me to come on this radio, but he is not very happy these days about the public and about the situation in America. He doesn't feel like doing it. So here you are as their representative, so to speak, also. I want to talk about fiction and politics in the wider sense of the world. How do you feel about the idea that a novel or any kind of non-fiction or fiction in your magazine must have a hidden or not so hidden message without losing its art aspect?
Let me, I mean, since you're invoking these names that I'm, you know, look, I mean, I'm a pipsqueak here, so I mean, but let me come back to Susan Sontag, and then I'll come back to the question of fiction, because the Sontag thing is sort of interesting to me. Particularly if one imagines, if one looks at the novels that she wrote, the last couple of novels that she wrote. I mean, I, you know, one should not speak ill of the recently passed, but it would seem to me hard to imagine. I'm surprised that you, as a committed writer, would have as deep a feeling as you seem to have for Susan Sontag's work, given those deeply middlebrow novels that she published, which, I don't know, I suppose perhaps you could find a message in them. But, you know, I mean, what was mainly distinguished by them was their, you know, their readiness to pull their punches. I seem to remember, like, the line at the end, there was a...
Interjection, point of order. No, I thought it would be interesting to have her here. I certainly wouldn't sit here as an applauding, not a...
Okay, well, let me go back to that, because, I mean, I think that's interesting, because, I mean, I just actually was on... I'm trying to get Russell Jacoby, who's an interesting writer who... basically an intellectual historian, who's written a couple of sort of well-known books over the last 20 years. He's basically the guy who's responsible for putting the phrase public intellectuals into the American kind of cultural conversation, which I'm sure he's probably not all that wonderfully happy about at this point, given to whom it's now applied. But that said, he was imagining there was a time in which there were intellectuals who had sort of a little bit more resonance, their words had a little bit more kind of, I guess he would say, popular resonance than is the case now. And I think you'd be mildly responsive to that kind of, you know, to his sense of a certain kind of decline in the capacity of writers in a certain kind of way to have a kind of impact on the larger kind of national conversation.
I don't know about capacity. I know it's no longer, they're no longer they are no longer asked. If
yeah, I mean, perhaps even flat out, right?
They may rise to the occasion if there was enough other climate for it.
Sure, but I think so. I mean, he's an interesting head, and he's got a good sense of the way in which the culture has moved in those terms, and he's not all that happy about how it's moved, right? But I asked him. The reason why I called him up was because I realized that a man named Paul Bocconi had died, and Bocconi was a man who was responsible for a journal called Telos. He started in 1968. He was at the University of Buffalo at the time, and he was a working class boy, came to America as an Italian guy, came to America when he was 14 or something, working class boy, and then sort of made himself an expert in sort of continental philosophy. He wrote a book on Italian Marxism, on Gramsci, that's still sort of the book that you read in English on the subject and so on. But in any case, in the 70s and early 80s, don't worry, this will come back to Sontag, 70s and 80s, Bocconi put out this journal called Telos. Actually, it survived until his death. It's still going to come out, last summer. Any case, in the 70s and early 80s, Bocconi he basically introduced America to the Frankfurt School, to the whole strains of what we sort of think of as Western Marxism, sort of all the strains of Marxism on the continent that were not essentially Leninist, not Marxist-Leninist. So you'd be talking about Karl Korsch and Rosa Luxemburg and Castoriadis and a whole range of, and Sartre, and he would publish, he'd do translations from L'État moderne. I'm sorry, I'm destroying the name. My French is no good. And if you were a kid, as I was in the early 70s, you'd read Rolling Stone to find out what because they had some decent rock critics in the early 70s, and some good new journalism. And then you read Telos, and Telos would be giving you a hint of this whole strain of relatively hidden strain of European Marxism. And then he went in different directions in the 70s, late 70s and 80s, and interesting directions, but still different. But the point is that this guy was a serious intellectual. He was trying to do the kind of things that actually first, we might publish one piece that could show up in Telos. We're from the beginning. We're trying to actually reach our vision is that we would reach everyday. We were not out to reach scholars necessarily. We would love to reach a scholar, but it's not our main audience. We want to reach, if we can, everyday people. Without condescending, we're not afraid of the word better. We have no, but still, the point is it's a very different thing than an academic journal, obviously. But my point is that Bocconi was a serious fellow, okay? I mean, an immensely worldly man, and as I say, did an immense amount when it came to educating Americans. And he also educated Europeans. He taught them about some interesting American thinkers, too. And I sort of think about this. I remember how Susan Sontag literally, I think the phrase that she used about herself was that she was a votary of high seriousness or something else. And I kind of said, I'll admit, I mean, this is really, it's an awful thing to do, but what the hell, I'll be provocative. I just sit there saying to myself, Paul Bocconi knew more in his little finger about interesting original European philosophers than Susan Sontag did. Everybody knows who Susan Sontag is because she's a celebrity. She fit into the celeb-mongering culture that we should be resisting.
Yes.
And no one knew about Bocconi, except sort of coteries, and that's sad. To the extent that you invoke Dr. Owen and Sontag, and I say, well, I'm a pipsqueak, I will also say there's a little part of me that says, well, let's stay pipsqueaks,
As I said, I want to deny that I was a happy follower of Susan Sontag. But of course, one has to ask then, why was she a celebrity? And what is the positive aspect of that? Does that make her more accessible to the American public? More interesting, surely. I mean, the great philosophers are not even known here. But that's part of that's a whole other thing that this American education seems to be on a slope in my mind, but that's not for me to bring up at this point. My own children, I mean, they know embarrassingly little about European thought. I don't know where that will go, but specifically thinking now of novels and indeed of short stories and of essays, should there be a hidden meaning to it, or is it enough to Is it enough if it's art, like Proust was art, without really any political? It's very hard to pin any politics on Proust. And how do you, what do you think of that?
Well, I think that, I think that this, in a certain kind of way, what I think matters not as, what matters is to the extent that, I think, it gets reflected in this crazy magazine.
You are an editor of a magazine.
But that's what I mean. I sort of have an ideas. I have some ideas about that, but I think in my head, how exactly those ideas have shown forth in First is sort of more to the point. But let me just say, I think in general, the notion that the explicit message or implicit message, whether it's politically forward, backward, doesn't really seem to me, I'll admit, to be the point when it comes to fiction, when it comes to judging its political character. What I'd say is that the central movement, my understanding, this comes out of Bakhtin and Eric Auerbach. For Auerbach. I mean, let's be real. Flows out of the Bible. For Bakhtin, it flows through Dostoevsky. But basically, you're in a situation where what you're trying to see is the way in which slowly over hundreds of years, everyday people, ordinary people, began to be treated as fully human beings, as not characters to be mocked, as individuals who were I think what was Whitman's line, to where the democratic averages are full of the kinds of grandeur and moral complexity that in other societies were left for the kings and the queens and the nobles. And for me, the whole force of fiction, movies, and one of the reasons why we're so interested in popular music is the degree to which that impulse, that great long history that basically, as I say, flows out of Jesus, coming back as a carpenter, that experience said you're going to treat everyday people as worthy and as deep as the kings. And if you do that, I don't care if they're good, bad, I don't care if you're politics or you have this kind of policy, it really matters not. I mean, what matters is that fundamental democratic truth comes out and flows through your work. And one of the reasons why we're so responsive to music on that front is because it so often happens in American popular music that basic truth is, in this case, people are not representing, are not being represented, they're literally representing themselves, So for us, the flow between, say Hemingway where Nick Adams is on the street and he's looking in the light of the world, that beautiful short story, and he's listening to the whore talk about her relations with the boxer, and listening to the gay guy in the corner of the bus station, kind of make his little move on somebody, and he's watching it all and taking it in. We're in a situation where we actually think that in this culture, you're now at a point where the Nick Adams, it's great if he's there, and God bless him if he's doing it, but, you're actually in a world where the whore is representing herself. Madonna, that might really be to the point, but whatever.
Understand you to say that mm-hmm. that Christianity is at the source of this?
Well, in Auerbach's line, his great book, Mimesis, I think he sort of roots in the origin of that. He does bring it. He kind of places it there. I'm no literary scholar, and I shouldn't speak. But yeah, he puts it there. What's funny is that Bakhtin, who is the other great, it seems to me, has the other great sort of vision of democracy and the novel, to put it bluntly. His vision is that, you shouldn't do the Bible because the key and root of the novel is objections to piety. You reject any vision of that there's one voice and one final word. There's always other voices, and there's always somebody else who's got a line on something that will complicate things and say you to somebody who's coming down as the one final word. And for him, Dostoevsky is the perfect person, because Dostoevsky's politics are explicitly reactionary, right? He was anti-Semite, for crying out loud, right? But if you're reading the books, the novels, he has the capacity to enter into every voice, every character that he has, and make that voice wholly and completely, while he's inside it, believable and full and human. you know, whatever is explicit politics matters not, because, you know, the force of his work is to say there are many voices here. There's never one voice. You know, it's fundamentally, deeply a democratic imagination. But in Auerbach's case, yeah, he sees it as flowing out of the Bible, and there's some part of me that is pretty responsive to that, particularly right now, because I've been listening to a lot of white gospel. But go on.
Well, anyway, we don't want to get into a religious discussion. Mm. First of all, I wouldn't be qualified.
No, I wouldn't be qualified either. I've been inside a church about 10 times in my life. But I'll tell you this, and this is a lovely moment, because this is just as we're talking, but Iris DeMent, who's a country singer, who's got she just put out, a record of white gospel songs, like 10 of them, and all of a sudden she wrote one. There's 8 or 9 of these. You know, these are, you know, Rock of Ages, and these are standard, you know, songs that go way, way back, right? But she's written one, right? And she writes one, she's a Good Samaritan story, basically, right? And she's talking about, you know, Jesus, right? And he reached down, he got right there on the ground. He reached down, and he touched the pain, right? I mean, since we were talking soulful before, Iris DeMent's got tons of soul. But in any case, you were saying, I wasn't saying anything, he says. No, go on. I'm sorry.
No, I want to steer you to a different kind of political thought.
Sure, do.
Not remotely connected with Christianity, connected with the Enlightenment, perhaps, with the 18th century.
Okay, that's fine.
And its writers, and indeed, well, Dostoevsky, it's interesting, because of course what he touched changed into gold. No, he was sort of a Midas of the word, but that doesn't make his basic idea about mankind and about socialism or whatever more valid, or not a bit, you would say.
Well, no, I wouldn't. He was a Slavophile and an anti-Semite. Those were his explicit political positions, I guess, at some point. But I'm also saying that, doesn't really much matter. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think that's the. Here's a way of talking about what the difference is. I mean, if this is, again, I'm stealing from Bakhtin here. But I think Bakhtin at one point has a lovely story about Tolstoy. Tolstoy and his wife, I think they kept journals, right? And they had one set of journals, which was sort of for public, you know, like the disciples would kind of read. Then they had another set of that was sort of secret, in which they kind of hid from each other, but they knew that each other were reading, right? And then they had a third set of journals, which were really secret, right, with ones that they really wanted to keep to themselves, right? And what Bakhtin does is he kind of sort of suggests that within Tolstoy, you had this deep vision, and, you know, at the end he was writing parables, right? He had a real desire to come up with a voice that was, if not divine, it was it. This is the word, okay? Yeah. And his line was that, you know, with Dostoevsky, what you have is somebody who has a certain kind of ease with, just by the very, you know, by the formal nature of what he's doing. He's kind of polyphony. He's always saying many voices,
Benjamin.
And that, I think, implicitly is whatever is explicit politics, by being responsive to many voices, He's implicitly a democratic sensibility.
Benji, yeah. Mm-hmm. Our time is up, I'm afraid.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Will you come back one day?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
You have listened to the WPKN book program Literary Discord. Our guest today was Benjamin DeMotte, editor-in-chief of First of the Month, a new cultural magazine, monthly, published in New York City. Our program will be broadcast on the fourth Thursday at 12 noon and on the second Tuesday of each month at 9:30 p.m. I am Hans Koning, the host of the program, and the producer of the program is Scott Harris.